played by James Hong, who you'll swear has been 80 for 40 years.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 122 of Recotopia. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Adley ho, Runnerinos.
And we are doing our show today on July the 4th, which is a special day for this country. happy 4th to everyone who those who celebrate the 4th. But we have some people in chat who probably don't celebrate the 4th. Who knows? We may have people who are listening to us right now who don't celebrate the 4th. That's totally fine. That's totally fine if you don't do that. Just don't be, you know, be unpatriotic. Be un-American. If you don't
really care. We will now stand for the national anthem.
That's right. Oh, my God. Can you imagine? Jeez. We'll go ahead and acknowledge chat because they are out here today watching us talk about movies. We're going to continue the series of movies that I have been recommended but I have never liked and don't like, and today it's Blade Runner from 1982. I have watched the theatrical cut, which is what is going to be the notes for today, but I also watched the final cut as well, so I'm well informed on this Blade Runner business at this point. But do you have any small, wait, I guess I'll start off the small recommends today.
It's no big deal. Itty-bitty
living space. It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Let's go with My Neighbor Totoro, a Hayao Miyazaki movie from 1988. I had never heard of this before. I didn't know this was on his roster of films. Apparently it was not a big, huge hit when it came out. They did re-release it in 2005. You can imagine my surprise when I was watching this movie and it said Dakota Fanning did a voice and Elle Fanning did a voice. I was like, this movie's from 1988. How's that possible? I watched this one and it's another typical great Miyazaki world that he builds here, where the story is about a father taking his two daughters to a new house out in the country, and the kids are start running around and eventually run into this bunny cat creature that is, some of you can see on our podcast on the thumbnail that we have down there, but it's this big huge bunny cat kind of creature, and it apparently, it feels like only the kids can see this creature, and there's another one that's a bit smaller and another one that's even smaller than that follow it around. Their mother is in the hospital with some sort of unknown malady that, you know, she's had a way for, and so this new discovery is sort of like a coping type of thing. And man, there's so many little fun Miyazaki-isms in this one. First off, when the youngest daughter lands, goes through basically what is an Alice in Wonderland type of situation and falls down onto this creature, and it calls it a Totoro because of what noises it makes when it wakes up. But the image that's going to be in my mind forever is when they're waiting at a bus stop and this big cat with 12 legs comes along and is basically a bus. It's a cat bus that can take you anywhere you want to go and everything. But this movie is really, really good. I had not, like I said, I'd never heard of it before, but if you want to complete your Miyazaki, this is a good one.
I agree. I recently got the most recent Miyazaki collect, or no, Studio Ghibli collection, not just Miyazaki, mm-hmm. the Studio Ghibli collection, right. And I've been working my way through these. So I've just recently watched this, and I really liked it. And one of the common things I'm seeing in watching these movies is the care both the studio has and Miyazaki has for the care of, like, the families. Like, the way this family, like, loves each other feels so real and authentic and interesting, mm-hmm. And good. Like, I just I really dug that in this movie. And yes, the cat bus is nightmare inducing, but but that is the beauty of imagination, right? Like, that's, this movie is kind of about imagination in so many ways. So
right,
yeah, high recommend for this one. As I've been watching through these, they're all really interesting and weird and fun, and yeah, it's it's good stuff.
Yeah.
My first small recommend, I'm going to start with some music. I don't know if I've ever recommended music, on a small recommend before, but, my favorite artist of all time, my favorite band of all time is Switchfoot. Love their music. Oh. I think they're super talented guys. And kind of the heart behind that is John Foreman. He and his brother, Tim, started the band, the Foreman Brothers, way back in the day, like 97. And he is just a really deep thinker and he crafts really well-crafted lyrics in music. And he has a new solo album out. He's done a couple solo albums. This just came out. It's called In Bloom. And it's my favorite solo project he's done. If you know Switchfoot stuff, this isn't as much pop rock as Switchfoot is. Like, Switchfoot is a rock band, right? They're a pop rock band. Mm-hmm. John Foreman's stuff is more folksy. It's a little more vibe music, a little more chill music. So that's the kind of music you can expect. But I would also expect really deep introspective lyrics that'll make you think and make you feel things. And it's just good music. I just put this album on repeat recently and just really, really dig it. So I thought I'd pass it along. It's called In Bloom. John Foreman is the artist. So there you go.
I think I only know the one big Switchfoot song. Maybe they may have came out with another one or two that I had heard, but
the two that kind of, yeah, Dare You to Move hit real big. Meant to Live hit pretty big. Those were the two primary ones that kind of hit big for them.
Yeah,
but their albums are full of great stuff. But so is this one. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. My next one is a movie that I saw last night, and I do have some reservations for. So it's going to be one of those kind of recommends. I watched the third in the trilogy, the Maxine Pearl trilogy. I watched Maxine last night, and this is a movie that I can tell you with confidence is very fun for a very long time until it hits a very clunky third act. It's a clunky third act that is very predictable too, if you've watched the previous entries. I wouldn't say that the things that happen in that third act are predictable, but where it's going, basically, you know where that's headed. And the movie starts off with a just a bang, like just an absolutely great scene, and it's fun throughout. But if you aren't familiar with the other two movies, this one follows the character from X, who we saw who was basically the first movie. Then they did the prequel, Pearl, but follows her years after the events of X, and her trying to get into the actual legit Hollywood film business, even after being known as a porn star. And it looks like she's got all the chops, but there's some reservations about putting someone who is known as a porn star into a legitimate Hollywood movie. And so she has to fight that a little bit, but she finds a director played by Elizabeth Debicki in this movie who believes in her and wants to put her in a sequel to a huge horror movie that she directed. And the movie frames this as the era of the Night Stalker. This is set in 1985. So a lot of news bits about the Night Stalker all the way throughout. And so she basically, it's her struggles to try to get in to make this movie while murders start happening around her. People that she's associated with start getting murdered. And of course, we're leading into our finale there. But I'm going to give this one a small recommend, but I will have some caveats on that because I felt like the ending kind of let me down a little bit. But I think there's some great fun to be had in this. Mia Goth, as always, really great. Kevin Bacon shows up. He's having quite the weekend with Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F., and all that. He has a very fun role in this. So lots of stuff worth recommending in here, but I think they didn't quite stick the landing on it.
Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't love the first two, but I'm still excited to see this because, I always like these big swings when directors are like, here's this thing I want to do and there's nothing like it. And I'm going to tie these movies together in an interesting way. I actually like the way these movies are tied together. It's not just pure sequel baiting. It's like, generational with a purpose kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool. So I'm excited to see it. I'll get around to it at some point. My second small recommend is the new Quiet Place movie, Quiet Place Day One. I really, really enjoyed this. I've seen mixed reviews on this. I think this is a movie that would be good whether it had anything to do with Quiet Place or not. It feels like one of those, almost like a Cloverfield kind of thing, 10 Cloverfield Lane kind of thing, where it's like, yeah, it's a Cloverfield movie, but, you know, it doesn't really have to be a Cloverfield movie. That's kind of how I feel about this movie. I think Lupita is incredible in this, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. I also really like Joseph Quinn in this, and I like them together. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that drives the movie's ability to carry the less active and softer scenes in the movie. And there are a lot of them. You know, the big scale set pieces do exist, but I think there are a lot fewer here than you've seen in the other Quiet Place movies. And so that, I think, has thrown some people off. I kind of dug it. I think there's a real beautiful theme here about dignity and death. Lupita's character is a cancer patient and dealing with the idea that she is going to die. And it probably hit me even a little more since my wife, as a nurse, has been nursing for a while now in a comfort care facility for oncology. So she's around cancer patients every day, and really patients who she's giving care to, knowing they're going to pass soon. And it's one of those things we don't often think about because none of us want to think about death. We don't want to think about leaving. And so to see this movie give kind of some oxygen and some light to the idea of how do you die with dignity, and to do it in this sci-fi element of like an alien attack was really interesting to me. I really dug it. There are a few really beautiful scenes in this movie that I really liked. So recommend from me. I do know it's getting some mixed reviews though, but A Quiet Place Day One.
And it made like $100 million over 5 days.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on VOD in 4 weeks. But, you know, people don't want to go to see movies at the movie theater anymore, Aaron.
Right,
I mean, you know, the Maxine showing last night, I saw two or three empty chairs. And that, just to me, I was just like, what are we doing here? Why are we even at this movie if there's going to be three empty chairs in an entire auditorium?
How can you not fill every single chair? That's wild.
Anyway, I'm going to go on to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Which is Blade Runner from 1982, Ridley Scott's. At this point, it's considered a classic and a masterpiece and all of these things. And I have been told about this movie all of my natural life, about how good it is. And I have watched it several times, and I watched it 4 times since we last talked on this podcast. I watched the theatrical cut twice. I watched the final cut twice, once with Ridley Scott's commentary, which wasn't terribly helpful to me, but it was a nice little insight into the movie, I suppose. I have never been able to get into this movie, and so will I be able to get into it now? Will I be able to recommend it by the end of this podcast? Stay tuned. All right, we're going to go into it. The movie begins with an opening crawl that tells us that the Tyrell Corporation has become so good at building robots that they moved on to the Nexus phase, a class of beings so close to human they call them replicants. At the Nexus 6 phase, they were stronger and faster and had the same intelligence as the people who made them. But why use replicants for anything positive when you can use them as slave labor on other planets Earth hopes to colonize? Somewhere off-world, a militarized Nexus team mutinied, and as we later find out, killed 23 people. And so replicants were declared illegal on Earth, and a special unit of cops called Blade Runners were sent to kill them. Furthermore, these killings are referred to as retirements and not executions. The first visual of the film shows us towers blowing out fire and lightning striking over a giant hellscape, looking both beautiful and terrible at the same time, perhaps a theme of this movie. We are in the city of Los Angeles in the distant future of 2019, where smoking in public buildings is still a huge thing and Atari is still going strong. As we get inside the city, we're taken into another kind of hell, an office with cubicles where Mr. Holden is about to give the Voight-Kampff test to a man named Leon Kowalski, played by Brian James. You might think the movie is being prescient about a loyalty test that will be conducted in 2025 by actor John Voight, but it's actually a series of questions that test one's humanness. So, not far off, actually. By the time Holden asks Leon about his mother, Leon shoots his way out of the building. Under a giant blimp that is probably lying to people about going off world to start a new life, we are introduced to our main character, Deckard, played by Harrison Ford. Some fairly clunky narration from Deckard clues us in that this is going to be told in the fashion of a neo-noir detective story. He's trying to get some food in an Asian district when an origami-loving Blade Runner named Gaff, played by Edward James Olmos, tells him his old boss Bryant, played by M. Emmett Walsh, wants to call him out of retirement for a special mission to go after the rogue replicants. There are apparently four of an original six remaining from the mutiny. One of them got fried when they tried to infiltrate the Tyrell Corporation. So the big question is, why do replicants want to visit the Tyrell Corporation? The movie gives us a rundown of the remaining living replicants other than Leon, Roy Batty, played by Rutger Hauer, Zora, played by Joanna Cassidy, Pris, a prostitute model, played by Daryl Hannah, and we get some exposition that the Nexus 6 replicants were built with the thought that they might one day have their own human emotions, so the Tyrell Corporation built a failsafe that would kill them after 4 years. Now, Bryant said there were six replicants and he only rattled off five. Who's the sixth? Well, the movie isn't super clear about this, but the Tyrell Corporation does have a replicant named Rachel that Bryant wants Deckard to test. So off to the Tyrell Corporation, where narration tells us that Deckard retired because he was done with the killing. And the only reason he's taking this job now is because he believes Bryant has threatened his life if he doesn't do it. Deckard is greeted by a replicant owl and Rachel, played by Sean Young. We meet the man behind the corporation, Tyrell, played by the Shining bartender, Joe Turkel. Tyrell wants to see the Voight-Kampff in action on an actual person, so he suggests her, and so he gives her a long list of questions. But during the questions, you'll wonder why the golden glowing eyes don't give it away before the questionnaire does. By the end of it, Deckard tells Tyrell that he knows Rachel is a replicant and isn't even aware of it. Tyrell confirms this and says she's an experiment. They've been giving her false memories as a cushion for her emotions, which allows them to control her better. The next lead is Leon's apartment, where Deckard finds a bunch of photos in a drawer and a small snake scale in the tub. Before we can find out the significance of that, we cut to Roy Batty and Leon paying a visit to Chu, played by James Hong, who you'll swear has been 80 for 40 years. Chu's specialty with replicants is creating their eyes. They torture Chu by removing his jacket in an extremely cold room, and he eventually gives them the name of J.F. Sebastian, played by William Sanderson. Deckard goes back to his place where he finds Rachel hiding out in the elevator and full of questions about who she really is. When he asks her about a childhood memory, he tells her that the memory is Tyrell's niece's before unconvincingly saying it was a bad joke. Then she leaves, bringing her existential crisis with her. We cut to the outside of an apartment building where Pris lies down in a bunch of garbage and lays the damsel in distress con real thick on J.F. Sebastian, who invites her in to what we are told is a completely empty building where he is the only resident because apparently there is no housing crisis. We are introduced into his Alice in Wonderland-like apartment where we see some friends that he built that populate the room with him, not replicants, but toys that offer company. We find out he's a genetic designer of some sort for the Tyrell Corporation. Deckard then takes a look at Leon's photos and probably one of the most famous zoom and enhance scenes in history, eventually zooming and enhancing until he notices a woman in a bathtub that is most definitely Zora, one of the replicants he's looking for. He then looks at the snake scale, finding someone on the sheet who can study it and find a serial number on it, which leads him to the man who made it. All he needs from that guy is who he sold this particular snake to, which leads him to a Hunger Games-like smoking party where they're about to take in a sex show complete with a snake starring Zora. Afterwards, Deckard pretends to be a stripper inspector in the movie's lone comic relief scene, but that genius subterfuge is sussed out and Zora beats him up before running and setting up a chase that culminates in Deckard shooting Zora while she crashes into 1.5 million plate glass windows. The narration tells us that Deckard is none too pleased with himself after shooting a woman in the back. He's no longer referring to the replicants as things and seeing them as human beings, probably because he's in love with Rachel. Bryant flies out to the area to tell Deckard that there are four more replicants to go. Deckard corrects him that it's three, but Bryant explains that Rachel is also on the kill list, which will likely be a huge turnoff. After this, Leon confronts Deckard because he apparently was around to witness Zora's death. Leon shows he's truly human by wasting a lot of time trying to kill him, which leads to a true Deus Ex Machina when Rachel shoots Leon in the head. Back at Deckard's apartment, Rachel asks if Deckard will chase her if she goes north and disappears, but he says he won't because he owes her one. But she'd always be on the run even if he isn't the one to chase her. She also asked Deckard if he's ever taken that Voight-Kampff test himself, and one of the few clues in this movie that he might not be human either, or at least may not pass the test given the nonsensical nature of it. Movie will now take a break while Rachel plays a little bit of piano and lets down her hair. A drunk Deckard tries to kiss Rachel but is rebuffed, and when she tries to leave, he does his best imitation of Baby It's Cold Outside. And he seems to force feed her commands that she follows, making her believe she's in love with him too. At least that's how I interpreted it. We cut back to Sebastian's apartment. Some exposition tells us that Sebastian, despite looking like a man in his 40s, is actually 25 because of Methuselah syndrome. And then that this is the reason he was not allowed to go off world. And one of the few observations this movie has of its world outside its own story. Roy finally shows up and tells Pris that there are only two of them now. And we get to the crux of why the replicants are looking for Tyrell. They want him to add more years on their lives, which are about to come to their four-year end. After questioning Sebastian, he discovers that he has a small connection to Tyrell that will be the key to confronting him, a chess match. They go to the Tyrell Corporation, and while stopped on the elevator, he is able to play three moves to checkmate on Tyrell, who does not wonder why a guy would come all this way to talk chess moves over an intercom with him. However, this allows him access. The Tyrell security system doesn't seem to care there's a replicant on board either. Roy immediately starts grilling Tyrell about the lifespan of a replicant, asking about different methods that could be used to help him increase it, only to have all these ideas shot down with various lab mishaps that, quite honestly, Tyrell is probably not being 100% truthful about. Roy worries that he's done bad things, but Tyrell is quick to remind him that he's also done extraordinary things. Could the key to what makes us human be in this very dialogue? Anyway, ultimately, Tyrell proves unhelpful, and Roy crushes his skull. Because Sebastian was with Roy when Roy murdered Tyrell, Bryant tells Deckard to go over to Sebastian's apartment. Deckard goes there and runs into Pris, pretending to be a mannequin until she springs to fight him, and a small skirmish occurs before Deckard blows her away. Now Roy comes in and there's a prolonged cat and mouse with occasional fighting and body parts going through walls in Sebastian's apartment building. There's a point where Roy tells him not yet and sticks a nail through his hand, a moment where we see a dying man looking for some last feels before he goes, which is a nice compliment to the chase, where he clearly wants a final visceral fight with an equal opponent. This chase eventually leads to the outside, where Deckard climbs up the corner of the building and on the roof. After running from Roy and trying to Ethan Hunt his way to another building, he nearly slips off and falls off the roof. But surprise, surprise, the evil replicant Roy jumps over and saves him before he falls, showing the complexity of humanity. Roy, in his last minutes on Earth, waxes poetic about the things he's seen, telling Deckard that when he dies, those moments will be lost in time like tears in rain. Roy dies, and it's not long after that Gaff flies onto the roof to meet up with Deckard, telling him that he'll be on the trail of Rachel next and that it's a shame she can't live. But then again, who does? Deckard goes to his apartment where Rachel is staying. He teases the audience by approaching a figure under some bedsheets while holding a gun in his hand. Oh no, could he actually be going back on his word and killing Rachel? No, no, he's just lifting the bedsheets with a gun in his hand, as one does. Importantly, it doesn't appear that Gaff got to her yet, and she's still alive. On the way out with her, he sees an origami figure on the ground, suggesting that Gaff was there, but didn't kill her. They drive away to some unknown future, and strangely, some footage from the opening scene of The Shining as the movie ends. And Aaron, what did you think of Blade Runner?
We are in a similar boat in that I've never had a lot of appreciation for this movie. I came to it late, so that might be part of it. I do love Blade Runner 2049. I think is really, really good. I love a lot of that, and that has upped my involvement or love for this world. Watching it again, I'm kind of in the same place. It kind of hits me the same as it always has. I did like giving it an extra level of attention because I think that does benefit the movie. And I think I've said before with this movie in reviews and stuff, it's a thimble of story and an ocean of aesthetics. And basically, this movie is about, to me, so many visuals and, you know, mood and those kind of things. There's not really a lot going on here story-wise or plot-wise or those kind of things. And especially when you're dealing with, like, character movement, character growth, character evolution, there's just not a ton with the Deckard character. You know, even in those old noirs, you get a sense that, you know, these hard-boiled detectives or whatever are, you know, growing or learning something about themselves or about the craft or whatever. And it almost feels like Deckard in this is, you know, at the end, maybe he's learning something from that final moment with the Rutger Howard character. But yeah, just it doesn't quite all add up to me. I do love individual pieces of this movie. I think that opening scene is really great and really sets you up for this universe and this world in an interesting way. The language is really poetic when you dig into, you know, I mean, everybody thinks of the tears and the rain, which, by the way, I think Rutger Hauer actually improvised, if I'm understanding the trivia correctly. That's wild. That's a great line. But there's other stuff like when they are trying to get that information out from the guy who makes eyeballs or whatever. And he says, "Chew, if only you could see what I've seen with your eyes," which I think is this really good line. It's such a great line. And so there's really poetic stuff in here. I also liked, "I'm not in the business. I am the business," as the realization, that Rachel has about who she is and her being. I thought that was really, really good. The zoom in and enhance scene is just hilarious to me. I I actually don't begrudge it too much in a movie like this when you're dealing with the future and you don't know how resolution works or how pictures work or cameras work or whatever. Maybe that's possible. I don't know. But it's insane. The shift per, you know, the perspective
it's
shifting
seeing round things.
Yeah. It's wild. So I do love that. Someone on the IMDb quotes page literally wrote out the entirety of the zoom enhance cliche scene, just like, you know, section 37, you know, to the right. Like, then I'm just like, what? Who's quoting that as like a movie quote? Like, you're doing the movie quote game with your friends. it just made me laugh.
That's just a waste of time.
That just made me laugh. Rutger Hauer is amazing in this movie. I love what he's doing, the way he's chewing the scenery. There's the one line that I picked up on this time that I just loved was where he says, "That's irrational of you and very unsportsmanlike." I thought that was really cool. So I do think there's a lot to love here. It just doesn't grab me as a story, as a movie. I'm not finding myself invested in Decker's journey or even this world's understanding of what's going on, because the things that it's hinting at, it doesn't really explore. Like the idea of Deckard being a replicant, you know, that's not really explored in this movie.
Not really, no.
At all. Even the opening scene, which, you know, is the test, the Voight Kampff test or whatever it's called, we don't really get a sense of why that works or what it is about empathy that is hard for the replicants to understand. Or, like, there's a sense of what, but not a sense of why in a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I like to dig for that why a little bit more.
Right.
So I'm still not fully on board with it, but I do find a lot to respect about this movie and the universe. And I think watching the theatrical cut was really interesting because I'd only ever seen the final cut. And they're so different. And it's interesting because, and I'm sure you'll talk about this too, you know, the narration is the biggest difference, right? But you can see why they added that narration. That narration actually does give a little more context that the movie doesn't give. It's just that it feels clunky and out of place because it's not necessarily written perfectly or...
Well, and it sounds like Harrison Ford, they saw him walking down the hall and like got a cane and drug him into a room and said, "Read this." And then he's like, "What is this? Okay, I'll talk like this the rest of the time." You know?
Yeah. So you can see why they thought they needed that, because to be honest, the movie kind of does need that. But it's just, it's not done well. And, it does feel clunky. It even adds a little bit to the noir aspect of it. Without the narration, it feels a little less noir because, you know, that is a huge part of noir films. So I see why they did it. But, man, you watch the final cut in just how moody and poetic the whole thing feels, and you see why Ridley Scott really, you know, loves that that cut and was able to do that. So, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I watched that final cut, and I ended up, I don't know if it's just because it's just a lot of stuff going on, but I really didn't see much difference between the two in general. Like, the narration is out for sure. I believe the final cut is the one that cuts in the little images of unicorns into it at the end. And I didn't realize this until I watched it with commentary, because I didn't know the origami thing at the end was a unicorn. And Ridley Scott's argument, which of course is after the fact, he's made this movie and he's put all this stuff in for a 2007 final cut, is that Deckard dreams of unicorns, and so Gaff would know this about him and his file, and so he leaves a unicorn for him at the end and all this other stuff. I think that's a big, huge stretch.
It's such a stretch. It really is. Yeah.
When I saw the unicorns, I was like, did Ridley Scott go back to legend and find some of his unicorn shots and just put this in? Because it's really what it feels like all the way through it. So the final cut to me, the scenes are definitely cut a little different and everything, but I still have the same feel of that movie, even no matter what version you watch, really. And I agree, the narration should just have been done a different way. And narration is kind of needed in this.
I think so.
Because it does explain quite a bit. And there are a lot of people who've come out. I saw during my brief research into this, I saw an article that came up that said Christopher Nolan says he likes the theatrical cut with the narration better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess it's to each his own. There's apparently 7 versions that you can pick which one you like the best out of this group. But, I haven't changed either on this one. And I've seen it now four times. I have desperately wanted to like this movie all four times. It is exactly the kind of movie that I get into. I love this 80s sci-fi aesthetic that comes up. There's that gringy, dirty visuals of it and everything. The one thing that I'll talk about, a lot of the things that I love about this. First off, the production design is unparalleled. There's a reason why this movie is so influential to other sci-fi movies afterwards. I love the fact that everything looks, there's a beauty to it and a terribleness to it. As I mentioned in that opening shot that like takes you right into this world, all those flames coming out of those little smokestack looking things with the lightning shooting off in the background and everything. But everything that's got this pristine look to it also comes with a lot of garbage too. Like there's that shot, it's a crane shot when they go into the police station, and the police station looks pretty clean. And then you see the roof of that office that Emmett Walsh is in, and there's like styrofoam cups and little dirt everywhere and all this stuff. So I love the fact that everything has this great outside veneer, but also if you look closer, there's definitely a lot of trash and dirtiness and someone is asleep at the wheel about a lot of things on this at the smallest point. The Van Gallis score in this is great too. It reminded me a little bit of Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here album, but there's some, I love that score. He had just won an Oscar for Chariots of Fire when he was running into this one. The score in this is really good. And I like the basic concept of this. I love being in this world, but man, the things that bother me about this movie are just like, I think this movie is Roy Batty's movie, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like it's supposed to be his movie, but we don't really get his perspective. I know that it's being told through Deckard's eyes, but it's only at the very end where he's like, do you live in fear? That's what it's like to be a slave and all that. And it's like, well, that's a good line, but also we've never seen you as a
exactly.
slave.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
So we don't have this perspective, and it feels like we should have more room, more time with these people as they are on the ship out in the universe, and they're planning the mutiny and all the reasons for that and everything which is, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Blade Runner had one of those 10 episode TV shows that come up on HBO one day or whatever, where they actually do episodes like this where we get to see Roy Batty and his crew planning the mutiny and everything. So there's a lot of things that leave me cold about that. The mystery too. So we see Deckard do some actual detective work when he finds the photos, and of course he does the zoom and enhance thing, and we see him get the snake scale and everything. And it leads him to a replicant who, despite their need to find out what's going on with them and what's going on with their lives and increase their, she's not with them for some reason. I don't know why. She's decided to take up a life of sex shows with snakes. I don't get that. I don't understand what I thought everybody was in on this for the same reason. And the fact that she was built, they introduce her on that, the little montage thing as this badass soldier. And I'm like, she's a stripper now. Like that doesn't make any sense. I don't get this. So the only detective work he really does in this leads to her. And it's just, it doesn't make sense why she's doing what she's doing. Furthermore, the only reason the plot advances any further is because Roy and Sebastian go to the Tyrell Corporation, and then he's told where to go after that. He doesn't find anything out on his own. He's just told to go to Sebastian's apartment, and that's where we're going to have our finale for some reason. I don't know why Sebastian's apartment is so important. Maybe it's because of the budgetary concerns they had with this thing. They needed to use a location more than once, but it feels like the Tyrell Corporation is where this should end, but it's we're just going to do it this random genetic engineer's apartment building at the end. I don't really quite get that. So this movie is always, I've never really been able to quite put my finger on why this movie has been leaving me cold so many times. And now after watching it as many times as I have gotten to the point where I realize now, yes, this movie is kind of a mess in a way. And a lot of the people behind the scenes on this, people weren't enjoying making this movie. And since then, they've done a lot of changes to this movie. A lot of people having ideas about where it should go and how it should be and everything. So it's another interesting discussion to have someday. What is a movie? Is the movie what we see in the theaters? Is that forever the movie, or is it always something that can be changed, like a special edition Star Wars or something like that? What is the movie? Just because Ridley Scott says I finally come out with the movie, that does that really mean, just because he's the director of the movie, do we really say that this is the definitive version? It's always going to be the one that you prefer, I guess, in the end. What, you have a choice, although you don't really have a choice with this one. It's hard to find the theatrical version.
It really is.
Of Blade Runner. It's final cut everywhere. So yeah, this movie, I like I said, every time I started it up to watch it, I was like, I love this. This is this is the world that I want to live in. Not for real, but in a movie.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I want to be there and experience this. And then as the movie goes along, I'm like, oh, that's kind of disappointing at the end. So there you go.
I kind of want to jump off of your idea of exploring ideas of canon, right? That's what we're talking about. The idea of like, mm-hmm. what is the story? What is the movie? And I think at the end of the day, it feels like you just have to accept that they are all different movies, even though they cover the same story. Like, you know, it's not which is actually Blade Runner. It's like, this is Blade Runner. This is also Blade Runner. This is also, and so you kind of get to pick and choose. It's the only other thing I wanted to mention about the final cut is it kills that ending, which was tagged on by the studio, which I think is a good choice. I think that ending of the theatrical cut stands out like a sore, like the happy ending kind of thing that happens at the end.
Yeah,
really, right. Stands out as like a sore thumb. If I had my preference, I think I would rewrite the narration to do a little more for the story and the character, and maybe even plant some seeds about him being a replicant somehow, like, you know, foreshadow something, maybe foreshadow the unicorn somehow, you know, in that narration. I'd take off that ending, have it end like final cut. And that would be the perfect version for me for kind of how I see what's going on here. But yeah, we all get to kind of choose that, right? And that's kind of part of the fun, I think, about loving movies, is the idea that we get to have those conversations and we get to talk. And we can say, I'd prefer it like this, but that doesn't mean that's what the director wanted, and it doesn't mean that's what the studio wanted. And all those, you know, things are valid. It's a really, really fun conversation and fun to think about.
That's always going to be it's always going to be the rub with these director's cuts, final cuts. You know, Coppola made three different versions of Apocalypse Now,
right?
Where you have the theatrical version, you have a redux, which is like 4 hours long, and then you have his ultimate final cut, which is 3 hours and everything. And then I guess it's just where you come down to, which one do you like? And that's the one that's your Bible at mm-hmm. that point.
Yeah.
For the movie. No matter what version of Blade Runner you watch, I don't think it changes enough to be like, oh, okay, now I get it. And now I get why people love this so much.
Right.
And usually a movie like this, if I don't like it, I can see the things in it that, you know, and I see the things in this that make it worth watching. I just don't know why it's just over the moon, like 8.1 IMDb. People constantly refer to this as this like untouchable classic and everything, even though it's been touched at least 7 times.
So much touching.
Yes. I'm forever going to be in this. Maybe when I'm on my deathbed, I'll watch Blade Runner and be like, oh, that was good. And then I'll die.
I think it also speaks to that we all look for different things in movies too, right? Like if you're the kind of person who a great movie is one that you just are in awe of the visuals of the world, then this, mm-hmm. if that's why you go to movies, is to see like amazingly framed and produced visual shots that you can hang on your wall. And some people, that mm-hmm. is some people's main reason for watching movies, is the visual artistry of it. Then I get it. Then I get why this movie would be in your top 10 or whatever. Like it definitely has that, especially the final cut, which does some stuff with color grading and adds some different things in there. The final cut is so beautiful. So I get that. That's not why I personally fell in love with movies. I personally fell in love with movies as an empathy machine, ironically, considering that's, you know, the point of the Voight Kampff test. As a way to put myself in other situations and other people's minds and experience stories that I haven't experienced through other people. And this movie just doesn't do that very well for me. I'm not excited to, see what Deckard is doing here. I'm not attracted to those characters. I don't understand them very well. And we all each have different reasons we watch. And I think that plays into it a little bit too.
With the understanding that I have of this movie now, I definitely want to see 2049 again, because I haven't seen 2049 in a while, and I want to see how it builds on this, because I did like 2049.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to give that one a rewatch as well when I finally get a chance. So
yep.
All right, on to our super secret double feature.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, podcast listeners. Danae here, and I want to tell you about Mint Mobile, because they saved me money, and I appreciate that. Mint Mobile also made it easy to save money on my phone plan. So here's how it works. Here's how to get great wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of their 3-month plan. You go to mintmobile.com/recotopia, and you're going to see all of their plans. And right now, all of the 3-month plans are just $15 a month, and that includes the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your number along with all of your existing contacts. And that's it. That's how easy it is. Just you go and you look at the information. You're like, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? The hardest part is just deciding to break up with your current phone people. To get this new customer offer and your 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That is mintmobile.com/recotopia, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. Heads up, $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to the $15 a month, and new customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what did you come up with on this one?
Man, oh man. I certainly thought of other ideas of replicants. I thought of Ex Machina. I thought of, you know, all these different. I even thought of like WALL-E, you know, the idea of, you know, off-worlding and that kind of stuff. But I'm going to end up going with something that I guarantee no one saw coming, and I'm pretty sure 90% of people will think I'm an idiot for. But I'm going to do it anyway. I couldn't get Oblivion out of my mind while watching this movie.
You idiot.
Thank you. I appreciate it. There's something about the central character's journey through an unknown, like, kind of future. A lot of stuff happening off-world, trying to figure out who he is, how he relates to these things. He's hunting mm-hmm. drones instead of clones, but he's still out there hunting, you know, to save this world. And the tone of the movies feel very similar to me. Even though Oblivion is a little more modern pop action than Blade Runner is, it's definitely not noir like Blade Runner is. They still have a very same feel to them. Yeah. And I think it would make a good double feature.
I think this is actually a sneaky good double feature for this, especially with sort of the revelations that Oblivion has for you later on.
Right.
So I think this actually goes pretty well. in the end.
And it's a nice underrated movie, in my opinion, too. It was one of, was it Joseph Kaczynski? Is that the guy? Who has gone on to do stuff that we really, really love. And I think he's, you know, you can see he's making a good movie here, too. It just kind of came and went. But yeah, I'd encourage, if you haven't seen it, to see it and revisit it if you have.
Yeah, I think I could be wrong about this. I think Cruise had not yet had his like second wind or his renaissance or whatever yet when this movie came out. Like, I think it may have been Edge of Tomorrow and a Mission Impossible or something like that that really got him back into that. And this one came out like, was it late 2008? Was it 8, 9?
2013 is okay. When it came out. He had just done Jack Reacher and Rock of Ages before this.
He was on it was a little bit of a tailspin at the point this movie came out. And then he sort of got his like second wind after this one.
Yeah, Edge of Tomorrow is the next movie after this. So
yeah, and Edge of Tomorrow was a really big hit. And so yeah, I if this had come out after Edge of Tomorrow, we would have probably seen something a little bit different. As far as I don't think it ended up doing bad at the box office. I think it ended up doing actually okay, but not like Cruise levels. All right. So what is going to be our homework for next week, Aaron?
Well, I'm going to continue the theme. I've enjoyed it very much. And so I am excited. I will say this comes from a place where I have a director, Wes Anderson, who I really like his recent movies. And I never liked his earlier movies. And so I want to go back. And the one that everybody keeps telling me I have to go back to and give another chance is Life Aquatic.
This is going to be a test for me as well.
So the Life Aquatic.
And I love Wes Anderson.
So the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou is going to be the movie next week. And we'll see if going back to it offers some more insight into this film.
So do you not like Rushmore?
Rushmore's okay. I didn't love Rushmore, and
that's going to be the poster next week. That's behind me, by the way.
So. That makes a lot of sense. Of his early stuff, Rushmore was probably the one I liked the most. But then, starting with the camp movie, names for forgetting me.
Oh yeah,
but hidden. Anyways, starting with the camp movie on, I've like loved every one of his movies, like loved. And so I really do kind of want to go back and give the older movies a chance. So yeah.
Okay. Well, this will be a good one. I actually have the Criterion Blu-ray on this one, so I think it's been uncracked open and everything. So so I'll have a fresh look at this one. I saw it in theaters and I did not like this one at all. And I was a bit, and this is coming from somebody who liked everything Wes Anderson had come out with up until that point. All right. I guess we have room for a question.
Sure.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What movie in your top 10 is only there for sentimental reasons and not actual quality?
I'm going to go with on this one, the Princess Bride is where I ended up landing on this one. I do balk at the question a little bit because all of my favorite movies are a combination of these things, right? Like that is, maybe that's just my math equation, but like sentimental reasons is a huge part of why they're my, you know, favorite movies. Now, if you're talking about the weird distinction between favorite and best, maybe that's what we're talking about here, like the best movies. I actually don't have a top 10 best movies. I've never done that exercise and tried to figure out the difference. So my list is favorites, and they're going to have a lot of sentimental there. Princess Bride is a great movie, though, isn't it? Like, that's the thing. I don't know that the quality's bad, but of the ones, this is like so much sentimental that I don't know how to gauge the quality as best. I can see myself being overly biased towards this one because of how sentimental I am.
I get the sense that question has always been like the difference between a best and a favorite and everything. like a best movie is something that does everything technically well. Like the acting is amazing and the story is great. And, you know, there's something fun they did with the camera a few times. And there's like all these different moments that add up to this being a well-made film and it's best or whatever. But despite all of those things that are great about it, they may not be your favorite movie. It may not culminate in your favorite movie. And a lot of times our favorite movies are things like this, Princess Bride, which is kind of a perfect movie, I think. Like it
feels like it.
It's one of those perfect movies. It doesn't do anything like super, super amazing as far as like a film nerd type of thing, but story wise and magic wise and, you know, comedy and entertainment, it's a lot of stuff all together in The Princess Bride that make it such a great movie.
And I think I was also limited because it says in your top 10. Well, I literally have a top 10, so I know which 10 movies I'm looking at, and it was hard to go. So I could even like Singing in the Rain. No, that's a high quality film. Finding Nemo. No, that's a perfect movie. You know, North by Northwest. You know what I mean? Like I could go through my top 10 and just go, I don't know that any of them are poor quality. If I was going outside my top 10, I know I'd go to Swing Kids. We've talked about Swing Kids all the time. Yeah. Swing Kids is not actually a high quality film, I don't think, but boy, do I love that movie. So that would probably be my answer if I was allowed to go outside my top 10. But inside my top 10, I think I had to go with Princess Bride.
Yeah, I took it very much like this, like movies that maybe I've seen a million times and I love and maybe wouldn't make a top 10 best or whatever. And one of the movies, the movie that I'm going to bring up is something that I watched a ton in the 80s and it contributed to my love of baseball that was going on at the time. And that's The Natural. The Natural is one of my all-time favorite movies. There are a lot of naysayers about this movie, but it's one of those that it really taps into sort of the magic of a mythical player that can do whatever he wants, essentially. And you see the rise and fall of this player because of various mishaps in life that he takes and everything. But it's hard. I've had this movie on almost every version of media that you can think of. And there's parts in that I've rewound several times, watching Roy Hobbs break the clock in Wrigley Field, watching Roy Hobbs hit that game winning home run at the end of the movie. I've seen these scenes millions of times and they mean a lot to me. Even though the movie itself, if I were to like go and do a real deep dive and everything, I'd be like, well, there's some things about it that I don't really ultimately like, but it's one of my favorites. So
yeah, that's a good call.
Going over to the chat and what do they have to say? JC from the national champion Vols baseball team brings up Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Ooh.
Then we have Castro who says Stranger Than Fiction. And that's a good movie. I haven't seen it in forever, but that's a good one. History Lover says, for me, maybe It's a Wonderful Life. The quality is great, but it's probably more sentimental. I also can't really gauge the quality of it. Yeah, that's one that kind of falls on that line. Like you were talking about Singing in the Rain,
sure,
which I think kind of teeters on that, you know, like it can be a lot of people's favorites and best at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, It's a Wonderful Life, certainly one of those.
Yep.
Slab says, mine will be Ferris Bueller. Yeah, Ferris Bueller is great. Josh says, I say Labyrinth. I hate musicals. I hate puppet movies, but somehow this one gets a pass. Labyrinth is fun. Labyrinth is a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Is it Scott Lego? I can't remember. It says Meet the Spartans. Oh no. Terrible movie. But my little 10-year-old brain thought it was peak comedy. See, that's kind of in that zone, right?
Yeah.
Like it's one of those type of things.
Although if Meet the Spartans is in your top 10 movies of all time, then, you know, we'll have a conversation. We can have that conversation.
Yeah, but that's a good selection from the chat. All right, that's gonna do it for this week. Thank you guys for coming out and watching us talk about movies today on July 4th and everything. We will be going to Thursday next week as well. It will not be on Tuesday, it'll be on Thursday. The homework is Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. I am very interested to go into this one again. Can it impress me this time? I don't know. But that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
We have, you know, probably four or five houses right around us that go all out. We live in a state where fireworks are pretty much completely legal, so they can just buy whatever they want and blow stuff up. So, so yeah, we've got quite a few shows, like a 360 kind of aerial view if we want to sit out on our deck and watch pretty colors explode into the sky. You know, the 4th of July, it's become a tradition. It's a thing. Like, everybody knows, you know, if you've got animals, you know, or you deal with stuff, like, you find ways to process through that and take care of it. You know, 4th of July evening, got it. It's all the stuff around 4th of July where it's like, oh, you've just got an excuse just to blow stuff up for a two-week period here. And it's just like, can't we just keep it to that one time? I don't want to, you know, I don't want to take anybody's, like, fun away, but I'm just saying it's, you know, if pet owners and veterans or whoever can't be prepared, that just makes it a lot tougher.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's annoying.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'd sort of lost the magic of fireworks many, many years ago. So I don't really care. I'd rather them not be shot anytime at this point. But yeah, I don't really get excited about firework shows or anything like that. And they get more and more spectacular and huge every year. And it's like, it's still a lot of the same stuff over and over and over again to me. So
do they though? Like, when's the last time you saw a type of firework explosion that was really significantly different than anything you'd seen before? You know what I mean? Like, I don't, like, is there, like, innovation in the fireworks industry?
I don't know if I said something that made you make that response, but everything is the same to me as well. Yeah. There's no difference, but, like, the what I mean by spectacular is, like, they put more into it so that they fire more fireworks than they have ever fired before.
Right, so they blow more stuff up. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But no, there isn't anything, as far as I know, new in the, I mean, I think if there were new innovations, we would see them every year. They're like, you know, look, we've able to shoot fireworks that go into the constellation Orion, you know.
The thing I love that I wish it would turn to, although you can't sell this, so there's not like an economy around this that makes any sense, but like the drone shows, those are cool. Like, you know, like where like you have 100 drones that are programmed with lights and stuff to make certain formations, and they make 3D formations and spin around stuff. That stuff's awesome. Like, that beats any fireworks show any day of the week. In cities and stuff, I think should move to like stuff like that, but it's impossible to traditions that are that ingrained. It's just impossible to get out of people's consciousness. And like you said, like, so many families look forward to it as like a family thing. You know, I'm going to take my kids to see stuff blow up in the sky. And, you know, we did the same thing. You know, we took our kids to see fireworks shows. So, like, you know, I totally get it. Because when you're a kid, it is kind of like that, like, whoa, kind of thing. But yeah, as you grow up, you're kind of like, yeah, I've seen the one that blows up and then blows up again. Yeah, that I know that one. I've seen the one that blows up and then slowly rains down. Yep, seen that one before. Yep. Oh, red? Yep, seen red before. Green there too?
Yeah, exactly. No, I think I recall seeing green a few years ago
No, they've never had green. I'm actually so far behind on TV right now. which happens every once in a while, but especially when you've got like the big shows that all come out at the same time, like The Boys, House of the Dragon, Acolyte, like all that stuff's happening at the same time. So like keeping up is, you know, full-time job, it feels like.
It really is. It really is. I certainly can't keep up. I have to kind of, I have to wait them out and sometimes watch seasons in one, you know, week or something like that. Not keep up with, like, that's what I did with Invincible when I watched it. Like,
right.
It was already, I think, I can't remember how many seasons now, two or three?
Two.
It was two. So as soon as the second season was over, that's when I started season one and went through the rest of them. And The Boys, I have started that. It's not that I don't like the show. It's just that I've started that show twice, I think. And I'm like, man, if I want to get back into it again, I'm going to feel like I'm going to need to watch that season one again. And it's going to be going over all the same territory and everything again to get to season two. I don't think I've watched anything past season, maybe the first episode of season two.
Mm. Yeah. You've got Gen V in there now as well. Like, yeah, it just starts building up. Yeah. Invincible felt like three seasons because they separated season two so drastically. And whatever it was, 4 and 4, I think they separated.
Yeah.
And then The Bear, which all dropped at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to watch.
I'm halfway through The Bear. I got 5 more episodes to go.
How you feeling? You like it?
I like it so far. I know I can see why it's kind of been a lower graded season for some people, especially after you watch the first episode, you're kind of like, oh, what are they doing here?
that is the complaint I heard from a friend was that they've kind of taken the artistry too far to where now that's the point and the story's no longer the point. The artistry is the point.
So the first episode is like that. It feels like it's all artistry, nothing else. I think it's the second episode is like, oh, I get it, they're gonna be in this one location the whole episode, you know, that type of thing,
right?
But in the end we still have the same things we like about the show in it, and you know, it's still good. I thought it was interesting this week. I've seen Maxine and I've seen Axel F. And Kevin Bacon is in both of them, playing almost. I mean, they're not similar roles. I mean, they're different, but he's the villain, or he's a villain in both of them. There's no spoiler about Maxine there. He's a villain.
Right. Right.
In the movie, but it's always interesting to me when you get an actor. I haven't seen Kevin Bacon in a while in something big, and I haven't seen as much stuff as I used to. But it's always interesting to me when an actor gets that weird like gold rush weekend where they're in multiple movies in a release cycle or whatever, and it's like wow, that really fell pretty well for you. There's a bunch of people who've probably been exposed to Kevin Bacon for the first time, for some people of certain age out there, and they're like, oh, they get to see him in Maxine, they get to see him in Axel F. He's a fun actor. He's just fun. He's just he makes everything better, I think, when he's in it.
Yeah, I love him. I'm sure it's just somebody told him, man, I'm really having trouble connecting Mia Goth to Eddie Murphy with your movies. It's taking too many steps. Can you please, you know, create a clearer pathway for the Kevin Bacon game? Is that something people even know about anymore, the Kevin Bacon game?
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about that the other day. I was thinking that perhaps that game is so old now that people don't even remember.
Yeah.
And everything. Because that was late 90s, I think, when that became a thing.
I think it was before that, because I was definitely playing that game waiting in amusement park lines in my senior year of high school. So that would have been like 93, 94. Somewhere in that range. Because that was like, because you didn't have phones, right? So you would play these games while you were waiting in lines or whatever to pass the time. And, you know, whether they be alphabet games or actor games or the Kevin Bacon game, which just kind of blew up. So
there was this thing that came out a few years after that. That game was a, had become such a phenomenon and everything that, you know, why did they pick Kevin Bacon out of all the actors? Why did they pick Kevin Bacon? And I really do think it's just, it rhymed with separation essentially. Like the so let's put Kevin Bacon, and they, and Kevin Bacon is another guy who's been in so many movies with big, huge casts.
Right. Exactly.
So that was a big thing, but like they did a study or whatever. And they said that the one actor that you would really want to do this with is Rod Steiger, because apparently of all the actors out there in the that has ever been who's done so much work and been connected to so many people, you'd want to do Rod Steiger. And I'm like, well, the 6 degrees of Rod Steiger probably wouldn't have caught on.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.